Today is Friday, March 18th, 2010, and today we will be dedicating our full hour to resistance to police brutality here in Toronto. We have exclusive interviews with Malcolm X grassroots movement in the New York City. We also have audio from March 15th demonstration against police brutality that happened here in Toronto outside 51 Division on March 15th, and an interview with the Ottawa Forum on Police Violence, Incarceration, and Alternatives. That interview is with Bridget Tolley, a grandmother of five from the Kittigan 21B1 Algonquin First Nations in Quebec. But first, the headlines.
Today, Haiti's former president is set to return home, ending 7 years in exile in South Africa, South African officials have said. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's diplomatic passport was delivered last month, and South Africa's cabinet minister Colin Chabane said on Thursday, quote, "We can't hold him hostage if he wants to go." The announcement came as Barack Obama, the U.S. president, made last-ditch efforts to prevent his return over concerns that Aristide's presence in Haiti could disrupt elections to be held on March 20th. Actor Danny Glover has arrived in South Africa to try to escort the ousted leader home. Glover, who is chair of Trans Africa Social Justice Forum, asked why Haiti's former president, Jean-Claude Duvalier, could return home unhindered and not the twice democratically elected Aristide. Quote, "People of good conscience cannot be held idle while a former dictator is able to return unhindered, while a democratic leader who peacefully handed over power to another elected president is restricted from returning to his country by external forces," Glover wrote on the Trans Africa Forum website.
In Vancouver, Coast Salish territories, members of No One Is Illegal arrived to challenge and confront Immigration Minister Jason Kenney at a citizenship ceremony on Monday, where he had made an announcement regarding the new citizenship guide. According to Nassim Alberdo of No One Is Illegal, quote, "Approximately 25 of us, including many recent immigrants, came to protest and challenge this repressive minister of censorship and deportation. It is clear that he only wanted a photo op as part of his so-called ethnic media strategy," end quote. He hid out the whole time while we waited and surrounded the door in anticipation of his arrival. Instead, he had over 10 police officers violently remove us, and two people were repeatedly threatened with arrest. Apparently, we have the right to protest outside, but not to actually challenge and question him to his face. Harsha Walia added, there's only so long that Kenny can continue to hide from a growing grassroots movement that is rejecting his two-faced hypocrisy and repressive policies. On the one hand, Kenny appears at ceremonies like this one today to purportedly show how welcoming he is, while in reality his actions demonstrate an anti-immigrant sentiment. Canada is not more welcoming to immigrants under Kenny. The statistics speak for themselves. In Vancouver alone, hundreds of Tamil refugees who arrived over 7 months ago continue to be detained in jails. Meanwhile, Kenny has drastically expanded slave-like temporary worker programs under which migrant workers are exploited as cheap labor without basic rights. Deportation is a daily experience for refugees, non-status people, and migrant workers.
And in our final headline, the United States has denied a travel visa to Malaya Joya, an acclaimed women's rights activist and former member of Afghanistan's parliament. Joya, who was named one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world in 2010, was set to begin a 3-week U.S. tour to promote an updated edition of her memoir. Joya has also become an internationally known critic of the U.S., Canada, and NATO war in Afghanistan. Organizers argue that the denial of Joya's visa appears to be a case of what the American Civil Liberties Union describes as ideological exclusion.
A report released to Congress states that New York Police Department stop and frisk tactics, arbitrary stops by police that do not require a warrant, have increased by 21% in the last year. The report also shows that 88% of those stopped and frisked were Black and Latino. Lilith Clarkson of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, a Black radical formation that organizes in New York and throughout the United States, believes that the increased targeting of people of color by stop and frisk is due to increased gentrification and racial profiling, saying that, quote, "There's no sort of separation for us between high stop and frisk rates and gentrification or rates of moving people out of our communities. So for us, we equate stop and frisk to illegal racial profiling. A law prohibiting the storing of information, data banking, of those stopped and frisked but not charged was recently signed in New York. The NYPD immediately issued an internal memo, leaked to the public, that suggested officers store the data on paper instead so as to work around the new law. Community organizers are not surprised by the NYPD reaction. They say they will continue working until the comprehensive social and institutional reforms needed to stop the discriminatory policies of the NYPD are in place. I recently spoke with Lilith Clarkson about the proactive work the Malcolm X grassroots movement is doing to eliminate police brutality.
To talk to No One Is Illegal today. One of the first questions I just kind of want to start off with is if you can tell us a little bit about who the Malcolm X grassroots movement is, like where you're based and what the basis of organization are.
So the Malcolm X grassroots movement is a empire-wide organization that currently has 10 chapters, and what we are about is the liberation of African people through self-determination. Our sort of moniker is self-determination, self-defense, self-respect, and we use those three tenets in terms of how we organize our community. Myself, I'm based out of New York, and so we've been in existence in New York now since about 1997.
Is there a particular area in New York that you organize specifically, or is it kind of a citywide thing? If you could talk a little more about, like, what are the demands of the Malcolm X grassroots movement? Now that you've kind of brought up the policing and the challenges of policing in Brooklyn in specific relation to the Black community and marginalized people of color, can you talk a little bit about the initiatives around policing that the Malcolm X grassroots movement has been a part of or initiated?
Education, because everyone should know their rights when dealing with the police. protesters in the 60s. They use guns and we use cameras. Cameras have a longer lasting effect. And, you know, I'm sure as many folks can have sort of seen from the Oscar Grant sort of footage, for example, can be very powerful in pointing out these contradictions and pointing out the rampant abuses of police power. So our Cop Watch program, we go out usually on particular nights with two teams, and when we come across police engaging with folks in our community, we come out and we begin to video record, announce who we are, and when that interaction is over, begin to talk to the person to see if they felt like their rights were violated. And again, so we use that kind of Cop Watch piece one as a sort of broader mass propaganda tool to let people know that, you know, who's watching the police watch us, but who's watching the police? We need to be doing more of this police accountability ourselves instead of waiting for the state to do it. And on the secondary piece, it's also for those that who thought that their rights were violated, we provide them with the footage of what we took for them if they want to file civil complaints or if they want to file, other sort of broader lawsuit pieces. The third piece that sort of comes out of that is based on those two, we also sort of have a legal program in which folks who have been victims of police brutality and want to formally file either complaints or file civil lawsuits, we have sort of lawyers on staff that have helped people to file what we call notice of claims, which is basically, you know, you saying that I'm taking the New York City Police Department on either civil or criminal charges based on their conduct towards me. So those are, for right now, sort of the three programs that come out of the People's Self-Defense Campaign. We also are part of a broader coalition called People's Justice, which is, at this point, a citywide coalition of different organizations that are trying to promote cop watches throughout the different boroughs, as well as promote Know Your Rights workshops. And so through that coalition, we've been able to put up billboards which sort of say, you know, you have the right to monitor police. So there were a whole bunch of billboards put up throughout Brooklyn, Harlem, and Central Brooklyn, Harlem, and Washington Heights. They've also, through that coalition, you know, sort of have done Know Your Rights workshops in Queens, places downtown, and also most recently was able to put up a billboard in Times Square, which basically was a propaganda piece saying that, you know, stop and frisk does not equate to more arrests, trying to, again, sort of expose this contradiction that the more that our people are stopped in the street, that sort of, you know, leads to more arrests being made, or it is a better way to sort of solve crime, which for us is completely a farce, and it's just, again, the continued sort of, you know, repression of our people where we live at.
Can you talk a little bit about the reaction of the community to programs like Cop Watch and Know Your Rights, specifically, have you found any pullback from community? And then also talking about the positive changes that you've seen in Brooklyn specifically, since that's the basis of the majority of the work that you're doing.
So I think in terms of, it's a couple of things, I think. So in reference to the Know Your Rights workshop piece, you know, I've done many of them. And so it's always sort of two reactions. One reaction is, oh, I wish I would have known that last week. Or, I wish I would have known that last night. So basically, that sort of education program that we do for a lot of community members in Brooklyn is good, because for a lot of them, you know, we get phone calls, you know, after our workshop, like, yeah, you know, I did, particularly with the high school age, because those, the sort of 18 to 25-year-olds are the ones that sort of get vamped on the hardest by police officers in Brooklyn, and I would sort of say probably throughout the empire as well. You know, a lot of those folks are like, yo, this is really good information. You know, I use the information and it stopped me from getting arrested, or it stopped me from getting a quota, you know, it stopped me from getting a summons, you know, things of that nature. So I think on one hand, the response, it has been particularly good, where, you know, we get phone calls from folks that, you know, came to these workshops that we do, and they're like, hey, can you do that at my building? Or, hey, can you do that with the set of kids that I work with over at this after-school program? So on one hand, I think, you know, it's the reaction has been sort of really favorable. A secondary piece, though, coming out of that is, you know, the negative feedback is, well, you know, you can know your rights all you want, but is that going to stop somebody from getting shot, right? So would Oscar Grant knowing his rights have stopped him from getting shot? Would Sean Bell knowing his rights have sort of stopped him from getting shot? And I mean, to be real, you know, the reality is no. You know, there are extreme forms of police terrorism, but our sort history is that, you know, those extreme forms of police terrorism start with the smaller pieces of power that then roll into bigger pieces of power. So our people's ability to stand up for themselves in these minor sort of infractions where police are violating their rights and calling them to task on it, you know, in some ways we feel, you know, helps to resent those larger kind of pieces. So I think in terms of the Know Your Rights aspect of it, again, I think that that has been really like an eye-opener. You know, some people know some of the information. And so I would say with that program, I think throughout Brooklyn in the past, maybe we've been doing that program now for about 7 or 8 years. One, the fact that high schools are taking on that program and doing it themselves. The fact that I think just even in, if you're in the streets of Central Brooklyn with folks that are born and raised there, you know, you can sort of have those conversations about knowing your rights. And they're like, yeah, I know that. You know, my mom gave me the pamphlet about knowing my rights. You know, I think that there's more sort of community awareness. And so I think with that, you found, you're starting to find less people actually being arrested for minor crimes. Stop and frisk have gone up, unfortunately. But you sort of, on that side, you find arrests going down. I think that with the cop watch piece, I mean, you know, people historically, you know, would be scared to sort of videotape police officers. And obviously, historically, that was a lot harder, you know, with folks literally having, what are those things called? You know, actual having cameras, like handheld cameras, and the ability to get that. But I think that, you know, because of the work we've been doing in Central Brooklyn with cop watch, it's influenced a whole bunch of, you know, other new Africans throughout the five boroughs to take up that mantle. And now with cell phones, you know, it's nothing now for me. I see, you know, if I see a cop, you know what I'm saying, stopping someone, people start pulling out the cell phones and start taking, you know, start video recording, start taking pictures. Now what they do with it, you know, we obviously don't know, but it's definitely, you know, from like 5, 6 years ago, I definitely see a change in how folks in our community react towards police officers when someone that they don't even know is being stopped in the street. You know, so going from this dynamic of you see a brother being stopped in the street, you're just walking by, unless that's a family member, to, oh, let me just start video recording in case something goes down, I think that Cop Watch has sort of made that impact. I also think that recently with the billboards that sort of went up throughout Central Brooklyn and Harlem and Washington Heights, you know, that also sort of helped to already perpetuate what we were already doing. So those for me are kind of like, you know, some successes. I think, you know, what could be better is I think that just overall we need to do a better job of development of people doing sort of coordinated cop watches that are not the Malcolm X grassroots movement. I think that MXGM has been real good at doing MXGM's cop watch, and I think that, you know, Justice Committee does a really good cop watch of themselves in Harlem, but the ability for other community members to take it on is something that we still haven't necessarily bridged the gap with.
Thank you so much for being willing to talk to me today, and we'll talk soon.
No problem.
Oh, no, no, not again.
Yeah. Put your hands up, both hands up. Say, put your hands up, both hands up. It's Amp Live, Jayanah. I swing like doors open on scrapers out in Oakland, showing out in parking lots, side showing, throwing a, blowing a loose right out the roof, riding it. They come stomping in they big black boots and gold bags. Knee in my back, mace in my face. Blood I can taste. At the rapid rate, they strike in my back. Something gon' break. Get the shake. Prison can't wait. Turn up my bass. I got that new Deuce mixtape on steady rotate. Blue Dodger fitted covering a fourth of my face. My demeanor screaming, give me my space. Whether it's out in a club, riding a bus, driving around in a flatbed truck. Not do the wrong. Posse beat up. Amp live. Show your homegirls that we on in 10. Cause a riot in here until the cops come in and win a party let out and bleed out in the street. Tell your local PD you ain't gon' Rodney King me. Touch me, I touch you, homie. We gon' start thumping. Ain't no suckers over here, man. We gon' get it jumping. Put your hands up,
swing.
Put your hands up,
swing.
Put your hands up,
swing.
Put your hands up, swing.
They call me Zumbi, I'm human, constant, ever changing, and I'm nobody fool. The biggest click who banging is the boys in the blue. Try to play cool, have your ass face down, flirting with your wife too. This is the harassment with the siren blasting. Thinking about rocking the hit, shogun assassin style. Al pray to the Father to make a way for me. It's fit to be a slaughter. Heat up my partner, bamboo, it's time to ride. They disrespect the family, then somebody got to die. The loud on my side, and this is for the streets. And little babies crying cause there ain't nothing to eat. You listen to the beats cause it helped to ease the pain. Been 400 years, so I'm deep up in the game. My brain is immaculate with facts of the brutality. Write it on the tablet and drop it rather casually. Attitude rude, so your crew don't wanna battle me. Was a cool dude, but for years you always spat on me. And I want revenge. What goes around comes around, so keep getting it in.
Touch me, I touch you, homie. We gon' start thumping. Ain't no suckers over here, man. We gon' get it jumping. Put your hands up,
swing.
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 Baba Zumbi, huh? Bamboo release like a pit leash. Wish he would say something, but police be quick to stick a milli shots off. Piggy get his rocks off, taking kitty tops off. Itty bitty cop cop, what you wanna talk for? I ain't hearing nothing you say. Like, do I need to spell it out for you? Sign language it out to your middle finger straight out of my fist. Understand, bruh? Touch me, I touch you, homie. We gon' start thumping. Ain't no suckers over here, man. We gon' get it jumping. Put your hands up,
swing.
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 Okay, welcome back. You were just listening to a track called Swing by Zion I and Bamboo. We're now going to get into some more of our feature content on police brutality. It is some selections from the demonstration that was held here in Toronto on March 15th when organizers commemorated the International Day Against Police Brutality with a demonstration in front of the Toronto Police's 51 Division, notorious for the repression of poor migrant communities. The demonstration was organized by the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and supported by groups such as Known as Legal Toronto, the Jane and Finch Action Against Poverty, Barrio Nuevo, the Toronto Drug Users Union, and the Community Solidarity Network. A group of more than 150 people gathered to hear speeches and commemorate those whose lives have been lost due to police brutality. The demonstration was easily flanked by three police officers for every demonstrator, according to our field correspondent Craig Fortier, with dozens of undercovers and plainclothes police officers hovering through the small demonstration, at least two mounted horse units on patrol, over 40 bike cops, snipers on the rooftop, dozens of police photographers in surveillance, and a caravan of over 25 unmarked police vehicles greeted the peaceful demonstrators, showcasing the extreme gap between spending on police and cuts to social services in the city. Later, a small group of less than 25 demonstrators proceeded to march from 51 Division to 52 Division and were followed by what might be described as the largest caravan of police and security for the smallest march in Toronto history. The delegation eventually decided to disperse in a subway station, showcasing the growing police repression of activists, as well as attempts to limit criticism of the police in a time when their credibility is being challenged even within the corporate media. Yogi Acharya of Known as Legal Toronto and our radio collective here on CKLN spoke on behalf of the group and asked us to remember the story of Queen Nzinga, a CKLN programmer and community organizer who was arrested by police at International Women's Day in 2005 and eventually deported, making links between policing and immigration enforcement. In the clips we're about to play, you'll hear voices, including Phoenix, an activist and former sex worker who read a statement on behalf of Brandy, an Ojibwe sex worker, speaking about the day-to-day realities of police brutality that women, Indigenous people, sex workers, and drug users face by the Toronto Police. Next, you'll hear the voice of Anna Willits, a member of the Toronto Police Accountability Coalition and Shelter Sanctuary Status Campaign, who speaks about the need for communities to both fight police brutality but at the same time to self-organize and make the role of the police obsolete in our communities to stop needing to call the police. And finally, we hear from Gaetan Heroux from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, where he calls for people to continue to organize on the streets, including for OCAP's April demonstration to raise the rates and No One Is Illegal's May 1st demonstration for Status for All. So we'll go to those clips right now.
Hi, my name's Phoenix. I'm a former prisoner. I've also been a sex worker for 13 years. However, my current situation gives me puts me in a place of privilege to be able to be out here and expose myself, speak publicly on behalf of a woman named Brandy. So I'm going to read her speech today. She couldn't come today. So my name is Brandy. I'm an Ojibwe woman who lives in this area. I have lived in this neighborhood for 25 years. I wish I could speak at this rally today, but I'm afraid of the repercussions I would face if I did, because I've been a victim of police violence from this very division many times. As an Aboriginal woman, a sex worker, and a person who uses drugs, I've had way too many interactions with police, more than I'd prefer. I was homeless in this neighborhood for over 5 years. Being harassed once a night is a good night. Harassment is violence. In the last few years, I have been employed by a local agency, so I have had to work less on the streets, so my interactions with cops have become less. Still scared when I see them that they will stop me, CPIC me, a common occurrence. There are over 500 missing and murdered Aboriginal women in this country. Many of these women were sex workers like myself. These murders continue to go unsolved. We're seen as nobodies. Sometimes I feel like saying when the cops pull me over, my name is Jane Doe, because that's the tag they'll put on my toe as they sweep these murders under the rug. I know they want me to feel like a piece of shit, but I know who I am and I have my dignity. They can't steal that. They've tried. I hate doing sex work. They've tried. I hate doing sex work, but it's fast money and I have to do it because I need to do it to survive, to eat, to live, to pay my bills, to feed my cat. I've been married, I own a business, I own cars, I'm a mother, I raised 5 children, sent 3 of them to university. They all have degrees. I'm very proud of my children. I have 6 granddaughters and 1 grandson. I've done a lot in life. I had a real bad tragedy happen in my life. In 1 minute, you'd be surprised how life can turn a 180, how easily you can end up on the streets. It was devastating. It was and still is. I never got past that day. Being on the streets, the trauma just continues. The violence just continues. It keeps happening. On the door of the police car, it says to serve and protect. Protect who? They choose who they want to protect. Aboriginal women are disproportionately overrepresented in our prison system. We are targeted, we are not protected, we do not feel safe. The message I want to give to the police today is we don't need to be abused or victimized by you. We already are abused and victimized enough. Maybe that's why some of us are working on the corner. We don't need to continue to work to feel even more threatened, and then you ask, why do some of us get high? You tell me. I'm a survivor. This is my neighborhood. You only work here.
Hi, everybody. That was a great last line. In fact, the police often don't live in Toronto. Most often they live outside of Toronto. And they do come into our neighborhoods, and they cause a lot of chaos in our neighborhoods. I really appreciate people sharing their stories today. I was biking out today, out College Street, and got to College and Lansdowne, and stopped for a moment at St. Clarence and Lansdowne or St. Clarence and College to honor a man who was killed by police in August 2000. His name was Otto Voss. And there was a long, long struggle to try to get justice for Otto Voss and for his son and for his partner. Coming up on May 21st is another anniversary, the death of a young Filipino man who was killed on May 21st. Jeffrey Riotica. Another anniversary coming up that the brother just mentioned. Many, many anniversaries. And it's really important for us to continue to keep these names alive. Wade Lawson, Faraz Suleiman, Sophia Cook, Albert Johnston, all the rest. Byron DeBussy, all the rest. We have to keep those names alive because when people die as a result of an altercation with the police, when they are killed by police officers, their names are not even recorded as homicides in this city. Their names disappear. They are not accounted among the deaths at the end of the year when the Star does their annual piece on who's died in this city. Those names disappear, and we have to make sure that those names don't disappear. I just wanted to say a couple of things. Police violence looks like the deaths that we have all been talking about. It also looks like a lot of other things. In the case of women up at York University, the Toronto police officer telling women that if they wouldn't dress like sluts, they wouldn't be sexually assaulted and raped. That is violence. The neglect of Aboriginal women across this country missing and murdered, the neglect, the refusal to investigate those crimes. Even when police have those crimes reported to them, missing women reporting to them, not taking those reports seriously. That is violence. There is other kinds of violence, not investigating properly the killings of trans women that are particularly horrific and violent, and letting those killings of sex workers and letting those deaths go untreated for years and years. That is violence. Tasering people to death. Don Weitz is in the crowd, and he can tell you how many people have died as a result of being tasered in this country and in the United States. That is a kind of violence. The kind of neglect that visits on all sorts of communities, the money that gets poured into the display that we're seeing now, including this beautiful building that has been refurbished only to house 51 Division. The greatest construction projects going on that are happening in this city with tax dollars, with dollars that should go to services, as Gaetan was saying earlier. That is a kind of violence. So there is a lot of violence. The violence of police officers strolling through the halls of our schools, armed, in uniform. Their brothers and sisters harassing students on the way to school, searching knapsacks, accusing them of stealing, accusing them of being someone who looks like someone who might have been in the neighborhood at the time that something might have happened, and therefore we're going to take you in. That is violence, that kind of constant harassment. And the last thing I want to say is there are many, many, many people in this city who cannot even use the services, as bad as they are, of the Toronto Police because they are undocumented. And so we have women whose abusive partners call the police, tell the police that they are here illegally. And those police officers, once they come into that information, turn those women, victims of violence, over to the Canada Border Services Agency, over to immigration. So that we have women in this city who have absolutely no protection from the violence of their abusers, from the violence of their workplaces, because they cannot even use these services, despite the fact that every person in Canada, resident in Canada, every woman has a right to equal protection under the law. They have the right to be able to use these services if they choose. And we currently have the Toronto Police acting in compliance with the Canada Border Services Agency over and over and over again to lead these women out of one violent situation and send them back to another. And that is an absolute shame. And we need to be against that. So I encourage you. One of the things that occurs to me, the longer I've been doing this, I've been working on police accountability, such as it is. It's got to be bad when even the SIU is frustrated, folks. Even the SIU is frustrated, and that's how bad it is. It occurs to me that some of the things in our communities that we have to start doing is stop calling them. When I went past where Otto Voss is killed, my daughter used to go to school there in grade 7 and 8, and they used to hang around in the little mall that's on the corner of Lansdowne and College. And the people in that store were calling the police all the time on the kids. Any little thing that would happen, they would call them. My son goes to high school, was going to high school. Anytime any little thing would happen, the police would be called into the high school. When we have some social services in this city, anytime there's a little bit of a fuss, they call the police to come in. We have got to stop doing that. They are not good at conflict resolution. They actually usually make conflicts worse. They are not good at social work. They don't receive that training. They receive far more training on weapons and using weapons than they do on how to talk to people. They are not good at any of this stuff. They certainly aren't good guidance counselors. I don't know how they do as football coaches, but maybe we'll leave that to Rob Ford. So why do we bring them into these situations? Why do we justify an almost $1 billion police budget per year by giving them more and more to do? We have to stop that. We have to cut back how police are involved in our lives. We have to stop calling them and learn how to solve these problems ourselves. We have to learn how to support each other and deal with whatever violence or issues come up in our own communities. We need to learn to do that and be self-sufficient, because these men and women do not know how to do it. It ends up with people getting killed when they don't need to be killed. It ends up with people being jailed. It ends up ruining their lives, meaning that they can't travel, they can't get citizenship, they are deported. We have to stop involving them until they get their act together. And the biggest threat to the police right now, folks, is their own arrogance, their own overconsumption, their own overspending, their own over-involvement and stretching themselves far beyond their talents and their abilities. That is what is going to bring down the police services, folks. They are in crisis across this country. They are in crisis across this country. Scandal after scandal after scandal. They are bringing themselves down. They have nothing to fear from us. You have a lot to fear from yourselves, and you better get your acts in gear, folks.
I want to speak to these cops, first of all. I want to speak to these cops to begin with before we leave. You have to understand when you go out in those streets and those back alleys and you hurt people, that those people come back and they talk. It's clear from the people that spoke today that we know what you're doing and we're watching. Yeah. And we're going to watch. And when you hurt people, we're going to talk about it. But now I want to speak to us, to people who gathered here today. Because in the end, the answer is not holding these people accountable. In the end is make sure that we have enough to eat and enough and housing and all that shit. Yeah. So we need to go back to our communities and organize. Yeah. And then when we go, we have to take to the streets. And we have to say that we have to have these. We have to have these things.
I'm going to stop. We have to have these things. There's a protest going on April 1st at City Hall at 12 around the special diet cuts. I want everybody to come. But more importantly, I want you to go back to your communities and organize locally. And if you have a police station like this that's hurting your people, you go in front of it and denounce them. If you have people who are starving, don't have enough to eat, then you go to your welfare office and you go in that office and you say, we want enough to eat. And then what we do is we begin to talk to each other and we mobilize because we know it's coming. And when the unions are under attack, if there's a protest coming out with the cops, they get together, and we'll get together, and we'll fight this, and we'll take to the streets. And we know right now that they're getting ready. This is just a practice run for us. This is like, what are you going to do when there's 10,000, 100,000 people on the streets? So people, thank you for coming.
With word coming in from Montreal that 258 people were mass arrested this past Tuesday, the largest mass arrest since 1997 in that city, we express our outrage with police repression and our solidarity and commitment to support our friends and allies in Montreal who face large-scale repression. This evening in Ottawa, Bridget Tolley will be speaking on a panel at the Forum on Police Violence, Incarceration, and Alternatives put on by OPIRG, as well as at an afternoon vigil for missing and murdered Indigenous women that will be happening at Parliament Hill. Bridget Tolley is a grandmother of five from the Kitigan-Zibi Algonquin First Nation. Her mother was struck and killed by a Quebec police cruiser on their reserve on October 6, 2001. Since then, Bridget has been calling for an independent investigation into the police killing of her mother. She has also worked on the Sisters in Spirit campaign, a project of the Native Women's Association of Canada that was defunded by the federal government in 2010. The project was designed, amongst other things, to build a database for all missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country. Tolley and others assert that the government has cut the project because, as she says, they are trying to forget. Also speaking on the Ottawa Forum's panel tonight are Ashanti Alston, a former member of the Black Panther Party and ex-political prisoner, Julie Mattson, whose father was killed by Vancouver police in 2002, and Jaggi Singh, a longtime organizer and activist based out of Montreal. That panel runs tonight at 7 p.m. on the University of Ottawa campus, and the forum continues all day tomorrow. Find out more at policeforum.wordpress.com. I reached Bridget Tolley by phone at her home on the Kitigan-Zibi Reserve in Quebec on the evening of March 15th, the International Day Against Police Brutality. Here is some of what she had to say.
Okay, well, my name is Bridget Tolley. I'm an Algonquin woman from Kitigan-Zibi. Grandmother of them five. My mother was killed by the police in 2001, and I've been working on an independent investigation for well, till we got the autopsy report, and then it said that my mother was identified by a family member, which was not true. So then after, that's when I got curious, and I said, well, I want the police report, and I couldn't get it, so I got a lawyer to get that, and it cost me $1,000. So what I found in there, it was real crazy, you know, the address was wrong, the time was wrong, everything was wrong in there. And not only that, I found out that it was the brother of the police that killed my mother who was in charge of the scene. I said, oh my goodness, you know. So I definitely knew there was something wrong there just by the brother even being there. You know, this is conflict of interest. The family shouldn't have been there. My police force should have had jurisdiction to protect the body and the scene, and this wasn't done by them neither. So there's a lot of stuff like this that wasn't done. There was also the coroner made a report, and he never even saw the body, nothing. And the only ones to see my mother on the road that night after they struck and killed her were police, just police. And it was just like one big cover-up, and this is what happened. And this is why I've been asking for an independent investigation since then. And I asked Quebec, they refused last year. But again, I feel that there's a lot of conflict of interest between Quebec, because they are, my reserve, the reserve police are funded by Quebec. The Sûreté de Quebec, they're the employees of the police. And then the Montreal too. So everybody is getting paid by Quebec, you know? And then here I am asking Quebec for an independent investigation into my mother's death, and there's three police forces, and they're all getting paid by Quebec. Of course, Quebec is going to say no, you know? Their force is, I don't know. It's really been difficult anyway, and this is why I'm asking the government of Canada now to overturn Quebec's decision on my mother's case due to so much conflict of interest. And it was the brother that was in charge of the scene, you know? Who wants the brother in charge of the scene if the brother just killed your mother, you know? Nobody does. So this is one thing that, you know, I really want to look into. It's been like almost going to be 10 years there. My mother died. So, and I don't plan on giving up. You know, this is one thing I want to fight for, I want to bring out. And, you know, even if it's one, two, three police forces, it doesn't matter. You know, if they made a mistake, they should be able to, we should be able to tell them they made a mistake. Everybody is human here, you know. Everybody makes mistakes. Don't tell me they don't make mistakes, you know. Anyway, this is what I've been doing. So this is a part of my story that I just wanted to share. And I just want to get this straightened out. I would like the federal government signs this police agreement. The provincial government signs this agreement. And so does my reserve here, the Kittagong DB Reserve. There's another clause in this agreement where they were supposed to have a committee, a consultative committee consisting of one member from the federal, one member from the provincial government or whoever, and then two from our community. And this and this committee was supposed to be a place like for me to make a complaint to find out what the heck happened to my mother, you know? And this committee was never made, you know? So I had no place to make a complaint, and then, you know, because these committees weren't made. So that kept me from not being able to complain to nobody, and especially, like I said, with this clause, this indemnification clause with Canada and Quebec and all its employees, it's know, and I want somebody to look into this. You know, I have the agreement here, you know. That's one thing we really, really need to look at. This is how it started, was 2006. This is when I first started writing my letters here to the government, stuff like that. And then, I knew they didn't want to talk about it, or, you know, they didn't like me bringing up the subject. You know, there's three police forces involved here, you know, and I'm sure they don't want anybody saying, oh, she is right, or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, them there, I knew they were trying to forget about her, and nobody wanted to talk about it, and even in my reserve here, you know, people are in the town of Maniwaki, they don't want to hear about it, they don't want to talk about this, why, I don't know. They don't want the federal government to forget about her. So I wanted to bring her to the place, you know, to the steps of the people that were trying to forget about her, and that was the government. So I said, I was thinking, and then I called them Amnesty, and I called them the Native Women of Canada, and I said, help me, you know, can you help me make a vigil for my mother to honor her? But yet, it wasn't just my mother they were forgetting about. They were forgetting about all the women. So I told them, let's start a vigil for all the women, for all our sisters and spirits. And this is how it started in 2006. So we got that going. We had 11 cities the first year. And we kept going. We kept talking about it. And now we were landed in our fifth year last year, and we were up to 85 communities all across Canada and internationally in Nicaragua. So the awareness is getting out there, and this is one thing the government was trying to do, was silence us again by not funding the Sisters in Spirit. I felt that they were making us disappear again. And they want us to stop, and this is why we had to have a rally for our Sisters in Spirit on February 14th to make sure that, to let the government know that we are here, we are the families of the Sisters in Spirit, and we're not going anywhere. And we plan to remember them and to honor them and not to let anybody forget about them. You know, the numbers have been growing, and it's an embarrassment to Canada to see these numbers growing, and nobody's doing anything about it. Still, it's a national shame, and it's not, we're not going away, you know. They're trying to make us go away, they're trying to make us disappear again, but, you know, we're not. We're going to be here, and we're going to be here for a long time. Like the family, see, as long as they're stressing us, we're going to keep fighting.
Okay. Welcome back. You were listening to Bridget Tully from the Kitigan-Zibi First Nation in Quebec. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio on CKLN 88.1 FM. Just before we end the show, we're going to, and play you the final track, we're going to go through a few events that are coming up in the city. First up is tomorrow, actually. It's the Poor People's Assembly that's happening on March 19th, Saturday, which is tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the Davenport Perth Community Neighborhood Community Center, which is at 1900 Davenport Avenue.
Right, and there's going to be a free meal, on-site childcare. It's a wheelchair-accessible space. Attendant care is also available on-site, as well as Spanish and Somali translation and ASL English interpretation. So really, you have no excuse not to be there. It's at the Davenport Perth Neighborhood Center, and it's presented by the Bread and Brick Social Justice Group and OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty.
Yeah, and if you want more information about this, you can always go to www.ocap.ca. Next up is the Rates to Rates demo that's happening on April 1st. Ryan, do you want to give some details?
Sure. So Friday, April 1st is the Raise Welfare and Disability Rights Restore the Special Diet demonstration. It's starting at 12 noon and assembling at Nathan Phillips Square outside of Toronto City Hall. And that is also being organized by OCAP, but of course, we and No One Is Illegal fully support this action and call all our supporters to join us there.
Absolutely. Next up is an event that spans March 24th, 25th, and the 26th. This is the Movement for Justice in El Barrio.
Right, and so you have three opportunities to hear these speakers that are coming in from New York City on the 24th of March from 4 to 6 at Sidsmith Hall. There'll be an event by the title of Gentrification and Resistance. On the 25th is one being organized from 6 to 8 p.m. at St. Luke's United Church on 353 Sherbourne Avenue, and that's titled El Barrio is Not for Sale. It is to be loved and defended. And the final event in that series is happening on the 26th of March from 4 to 6 p.m. at Accents Bookstore on 1790 Eglinton West. And you can get all the details on that event on the No One Is Legal website at toronto.nooneisillegal.org.
Yep, and on March 24th is the event where the Women Behind the Grassy Narrows blockade, which as folks will probably recall is the longest running blockade in Canadian history, or the history of Canada. Ryan, details?
Sure. Thursday, March 24th. Location is Friends Meeting House, 60 Lowther Avenue, just off Avenue Road, at 7:30 p.m. Details and events in other cities at freegrassy.org.
Okay, two more. March 26th is the rally and march to end Canadian complicity in apartheid.
Right. So join us as we march alongside Palestinian solidarity organizations and community groups to assert our demand for an end to the occupation and freedom of return for Palestinians. March 26th, it's a Saturday. It's the Global BDS, Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Day of Action, starting at 12:30, and the meeting spot is King and Bay.
And last but not least is May 1st, the May Day of Action, the 6th annual May Day of Action organized by No One Is Illegal. Take it away, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean that we'll be seeing all our supporters on May 1st as we do every year. This year we'll be starting off at Parkdale, and all the other details will be released shortly on our website, toronto.nooneisillegal.org. You've been listening to No One Is Illegal Radio on CKLN 88.1 FM, broadcasting live out of Ryerson University here in Toronto. Special shout out to our whole crew up in the studio today, Alex, Yogi, Sheila, Luam, Zoe, especially Zoe for teching the show. And we're going to throw it away with a track by NECA, Heartbeat.